Okay, this is Karen Brewster, and today is May 8th, 2019, and I am here with Candy Norris at her home in Santa Fe, in the El Dorado at Santa Fe part of town, I guess. and this is for the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park Oral History Project. And Candy, as I said, your name has come up because you worked with Parks Canada.
Right.
But before we get to that, I would like to know a little bit about you. So where are you from originally?
I actually grew up in Vancouver, British Columbia, so I'm now a dual citizen.
Uh-huh.
So, and last year I lived half my life in Canada and half in the U.S.
Oh, congratulations.
But now I tipped over.
And what's your educational background?
When I worked for the Chilkoot, I had done 1 year of an outdoor recreation management program, but I have since done a master's in science and nursing. So I became a nurse practitioner after I finished all my trail work.
Okay. And so how did you get from Vancouver to Alaska?
Oh, that's really a long story. when I was in my late teens, I was involved in a youth program called Katimovic. And that program recruited youth, I think you had to be 18 to 22 or 18 to 23, something like that. And they would have you work in three different regions of Canada, and your goal was to do community service. So I think it's like VISTA. Mm-hmm. And then the other part of it was to learn if you were an Anglophone, to learn French or vice versa. So my last go-round was in Atlin, British Columbia, which is, of course, far northwestern British Columbia. And so I ended up kind of learning about, I lived in the Yukon in that part of the world for a long time, and I hiked the Chilkoot, so I got to know what the Chilkoot was, and now I have to think about all the sequence of events here. So as I was living there, I decided I was going to do this outdoor recreation program. And at the end of that, at the end of the first year, they were hiring for new, they call them warden patrol people on the Chilkoot. So I applied for the job and I got it. So.
And what year would that have been?
That would have been 1981. And so that's how I ended up on the Chilkoot. And then I met my first husband there, and then several years later, Frank and I met. So, goes on.
I'm going to pause for a second. So when you were in Atlin, what kind of things were you doing there?
Oh, what did we do there? Oh, geez. I know we had a big garden, so we were trying to grow our own food, haplessly, but we did all right. And we were doing some work on some old buildings in town. I remember we were peeling lots of logs because they were going to use them for some purpose. We got to do a lot of recreational things, which was fun. We did a big canoe trip all the way to the end of Atlin Lake down to Atlin Glacier and back, and we all survived. And I don't know, just whatever community kind of stuff came up. It wasn't any big major projects that I recall, yeah.
And how many of you were there?
In Atlin, there were 10 of us, and then there was another group that was in Dawson City, and then another group that was on the Yukon River.
Uh-huh.
So there were 30 that went to that part of the country.
And how long were you up there?
3 months.
Was it a summer program?
Well, it was Katimovic was 9 months long, so it was 3 months in each area that you went to. So the last three were up there.
So. Okay, and then you said you applied for this warden patrol position. Was that from Atlin, or did you go back to Vancouver?
No, I worked. I did a lot of seasonal work for up in Dawson City for about two or three years, working, doing tour guiding things and lots of different things in Dawson City because you can work two or three jobs easily there. Yeah. They love to have you work. And then I decided I wanted to go to school, so I went into outdoor recreation management. I'm really not sure why I picked that at the time, but I did.
And where was that program located?
It was in Vancouver, North Vancouver. And so I did 1 year of that. And, it was a good program for learning, good outdoor skills and, how to be a good environmental steward and those kind of things. So apparently it gave me enough knowledge to get the job, so right. I was happy.
So being a warden patrol, that was for Parks Canada, or
right?
I don't know if they were called Parks Canada at that point.
They were Parks Canada at that point.
And then
they changed it a later time, and then they went back to Parks Canada. They were Canada Parks or something for a while. It was somewhere.
Something in Parks and Environment.
Or yes, something. That's right. Environment and Parks, something.
No.
Anyhow, it didn't stick.
No, Parks Canada is way easier.
Yeah.
So what did that job entail?
The warden patrol job?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my. I guess the main focus was public safety. So we were there to patrol the trail, do trail maintenance, make sure the hikers made it across the trail because, of course, we were always dealing with hypothermia or all kinds of issues, health issues, everything from heart attacks to blisters. And we worked pretty closely with our American counterparts, so we always knew how many people were coming across the trail, and they would always give us a heads up for people that might be potential problems, just in terms of ability or behavioral issues or whatever was going on. We did a lot of resource management just in terms of the historical resource, just trying to record it, make sure it was, protected as much as we could, and making sure people weren't burning artifacts and things like that. Later on, there was more First Nations liaison stuff. I wasn't so involved with that, but I know they evolved in that direction. That was just starting as I finished.
Okay. And how many years did you do that?
10 years.
Wow. So seasonally for 10 years?
Yes, seasonally for 10 mm-hmm. years.
So you will know a lot about this subject.
Yeah. Oh, no, I worked there a long time. It was a great job. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. So when you were doing the stuff on the trail, were you stationed at one of the campgrounds up there?
Well, we had a big camp at Lake Lindeman, mm-hmm. so that was our base camp, and then we had an outpost up at the summit. Initially it was at Stone Crib, which was a little area just past the summit, and then toward the end of the time I was there, they got rid of the Stone Crib facility and we moved up to the summit. So we would patrol out of Lindeman, so we'd either do usually we'd go up to the summit for anywhere from sometimes a day, but most of the time for at least a few days, up to 4 days. And then, the next person would change out with us. And then occasionally we would camp along the trail. So we were in the campsites with the campers. And occasionally we'd stay down at Bennett. We had an arrangement with the Bennett Eating House that we had a facility there that we could stay in if we needed to. But mostly we were out of Lindeman.
Mm-hmm. So there was a structure at the summit. There's
like a little cabin.
Yeah.
It's prefab, so it's flown in and then we constructed it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when you started in 1981, were all the campgrounds along the way established?
Yeah, they were pretty rudimentary. I mean, there was always, places people could put a tent, and we tried to get people to go to the campsites, which was always a challenge. There was always an outhouse, but they're really, that's it. And now they've really upgraded things like Happy Camp. There's a cabin. Lindeman always had a couple of cabins available for people not to stay in, but, they could cook in there or sit out of the rain if it was
right.
pouring. And I'm not sure if they have much at the other campgrounds, but I know they have tent platforms now, because we went back and hiked the trail about 5, 7 years ago with our, we took our daughter up, and so I was, you know, impressed that they had changed quite a bit since I had worked there.
Yeah, and now, you know, at Lindeman, now that they have a fairly regular ranger program.
Yeah, I don't know, you know, I really don't know what they're doing there as far as the staff.
Did you do any kinds of programs along the trail?
You mean as far as education things? It was all very informal. You know, we had a tent set up in Lindeman that was historic photographs. Mm-hmm. And we would set that up in the summer. And then if people wanted to come over and, you know, have a little chat about what happened on the trail, we were happy to talk about it. Or, you know, if they wanted to know about any of the flowers or anything like that, or any of the animals they might encounter. But there wasn't any formalized programming that was done.
Okay. And so I'm wondering, in some of the job duties you were talking about, you know, patrolling the trail and being in communication with the American side, how did you guys communicate?
Oh, we had radios.
Even back in the 80s, huh?
Yeah. We had single sideband radio way back in the day. Single sideband, I couldn't tell you how that technology works, but it's not like a little walkie-talkie. It's a thing you have to set up, like big wire antennas, and it's like, it's a deal.
And was it, you had to carry it with you, or, I mean?
No, we didn't have, we only had that at Lindeman, so I'm not really sure. I can't remember what we used the first couple of years, because eventually we got like walkie-talkie kind of radios. And I think that was at, that was because of Jay Cable, who was the chief ranger on the American side for a number of years. And I think he really pushed that through and got a repeater set up so that they would actually work.
Yeah, I would think, I don't know the technology either to know the range of these kinds of communication systems, and that would it really work between sheep camp and
The single sideband did work. I mean, we did communicate, so it must have worked. I mean, they must have had a single sideband at sheep camp. We had one at Lindeman. And then we communicated with Whitehorse, and I'm not sure if we talked to Skagway at all, but we wouldn't have had a need to anyhow. So,
and then at the summit, was there a radio up there?
I don't remember there being a radio up there. We must have had something, though, you know, but I remember definitely for most of the years I worked there, we had portable radios we carried, you know, and we always had them with us, and we had to sleep with the batteries and things like that because, you know, you lose power when your battery's cold.
Yeah. Well, because thinking if you're keeping an eye out for specific hikers.
Right.
If you knew at Lindeman, that wouldn't help you if you were at the summit.
Yeah, so we must have had those portable radios right from the beginning. Because, you know, the first year I worked there, I met my first husband because he dislocated his shoulder at the summit. And we had to reset the shoulder because, you know, there's no way he was going to walk out of there, and he didn't want to pay for an evacuation. So we were in touch with the physician in Haines, Alaska, of all things. So I think we were in touch with the American Rangers. I remember there was myself and probably another one of the Warden Patrol people, and then at least one of the American Rangers. And then we were in touch with Skagway, who was in touch with the doctor who happened to be in Skagway. And he told us how to do it, and it worked.
Well, I was going to say that as the trail wardens, did you know how to do that, to reset a shoulder?
No.
Your first aid training didn't cover that?
No, I mean, I had, you know, I was trained as an EMT and I had wilderness first aid, and I think everybody had similar, but shoulder dislocations, they pretty much tell you, put it in a sling and, you know, get them out. But he wasn't going to be able to walk 17 miles to get out, so with his arm in a sling. And then he had this massive backpack that had to get out too. So anyhow,
so you reset his shoulder and he walked out.
Somebody else carried his pack.
Well, that's a good strategy.
Yeah.
Well, that was one of my questions, was you talked about dealing with hiker injuries or issues and what some examples were.
Oh, lots and lots of hypothermia. That was like number one, because, you know, the weather up there is unpredictable, and even if it's not pouring rain, it's always chilly because there's always a wind. It's almost never warm up there. We certainly had heart issues, lots and lots of sprains and strains and burns and blisters and, you know, foot injuries like toenails and all kinds of stuff. You name it, we saw it.
And so that was your training to assist them was your wilderness first aid and that kind of stuff.
And EMT, yeah.
You guys all, was that required training?
I don't know if it was required. I mean, they definitely wanted us to have some basic stuff, but most of the people I worked with wanted to get more. Because really, when you're out there, you're it. So you kind of want to have a pretty good sense of what you're doing. Because you're far away and there isn't anybody there but you. Mm-hmm. So,
were there people, I mean, who, you know, if you get a strain or a sprain, if you have a foot injury, that's, I say, a long 17 miles.
Yeah, usually we could get them down to Lindeman. You know, sometimes it was a very slow go, and sometimes we'd have to really babysit them down the trail. But once we got to Lindeman, we had a boat, so we could get people down to Bennett.
Uh-huh.
Then we could get them down to the end of Lake Lindeman, and then there was about a one-mile walk to the lake. And they, you know, in the early days, they could take the train. When the train stopped running, then there was a Casey car, so there was a little maintenance car.
Mm.
And they would happily take people out. And then there was also, for a while, boats going up and down to Carcross.
From
Bennett.
From Bennett, oh.
They were kind of a tour operator thing, but they could be... recruited to help if we needed their help.
I don't know about those tour boats.
Yeah, they're, I can't remember the name of the company, but they used to brought people across the trail, and then they get in a boat and they go down to down to Carcross. So, because the train wasn't running probably at that time, so that was the only way to get out, except to walk the tracks, and the White Pass Company wasn't too happy if people walked the tracks.
Right, and that would be walking the tracks out to the Klondike Highway?
Right.
Because by 83, the
train had stopped.
The train had stopped, but by 81, the highway was in.
Yeah, the highway was in. Yeah. And so we used to walk the tracks all the time.
It used to be on the maps for the trail.
Oh, yeah, and even when we walked out this last, because, you know, I knew you could walk out, so there used to be a cutoff trail, and they've actually tried to obscure the cutoff trail because they don't want people to use it, and there used to be a bridge across a pretty large creek, and they had kind of knocked that bridge almost to the point where you couldn't use it, so it's probably not there anymore.
Yeah, but, I didn't think about when the train stopped running, how hikers would get out.
Yeah, most of the time they walked. They took the cutoff trail and walked out.
Back to the highway.
Yeah, and there was a parking lot there, so sometimes people had two vehicles, so they'd leave one there and take one down to Skagway, mm-hmm. or there was a bus that used to go back and forth between Whitehorse and Skagway, so they would make a stop there. I think people could just flag the bus, or they'd arrange for someone to pick them up.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Were there ever airplanes? Did people use charter a flight to pick them up?
I don't ever remember a plane flying in from a person chartering it in. I mean, we did. We had lots of flights because that was our supply route. You know, that's how they'd bring in our stuff. Either when the train was running, we'd bring stuff on the train and then pack it over to Lake Lindeman. But when that stopped, then they would fly stuff out. I can't remember how often, but probably every couple weeks we'd get a load of groceries.
And they would fly...
From Whitehorse.
And land on Lindeman?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Did you ever have to have anybody evacuated by helicopter that you couldn't get them to Lindeman and walk out or boat out?
Not by helicopter, but by float plane. We had to fly some people out.
But that would be getting them to Lindeman.
Well, that would be getting them back to Whitehorse. So they'd have to get down to Lindeman and then get them out. But... that wasn't actually very common. So mostly it was we could get them out. as far as Bennett, and then they would be able to get out from there.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So nobody died of a heart attack on
no,
the trail?
No, thankfully.
That's good. What was I also going to ask about? Just other hiker issues that you sort of said, you know.
Oh, just people always overestimate their abilities, or they come completely unprepared for the weather. So we would always have lots of garbage bags at the summit so we could make impromptu rain gear. Use duct tape and black plastic bags and off you go. And, you know, people from the Yukon are notoriously bad about wanting to build fires everywhere because that's what they're used to doing everywhere else, and probably had done that for years before the Chilkoot was any kind of place that anybody cared about, you know. But mm-hmm. So we were always having to say, no, you have to bring a stove.
So were people hiking from the Canadian side down?
No, mostly the vast majority go from Dyea over to Bennett.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, you know, there are southbound hikers, definitely, but you're walking into the wind almost always, so it's not a very pleasant way to do it.
You know, somebody told me that also that if you walk nowadays, if you're walking the other direction, you're also walking into all the crowds of people. Not crowds, but you run into lots of people, so there's
right.
a lot of stopping and chatting.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And that would maybe, for some people, would be a slowdown.
Yeah, and maybe some people would like that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it would definitely mean you'd run into every person going over at some point.
Yeah. And nowadays, you know, they have this rule limiting 50 people over the summit
yeah.
at a time. Do you remember if you had those kinds of limits?
No, we didn't have any limits. So there was a time when there was a group called the Canadian Cadets. So they're like a camp for kids who maybe want to become, I don't know if they want to become military people or something, but they basically dress in uniforms. And they used to come up to Whitehorse and sort of do pseudo-military things that kids would do, not shooting guns. I don't know if they shot guns and stuff like that, but definitely hiking the Chilkoot was one of the things. And so we'd have days when the cadets would come through that it would be like 150 people across.
Wow.
Because they were like a group of 75 kids or 80
wow.
kids or something. So, you know, and they would always come at the peak of the summer when everybody else comes. So, yeah, that was bad.
Yeah, so where did all those people camp?
Anywhere they could.
So do you think this changed to now with these established campgrounds, you can only camp at certain places?
Oh, yeah.
Is that an improvement?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, because there aren't any outhouses anywhere else, so you know. And it's a very fragile alpine environment on the Canadian side, so you have to be careful about everything. You know, even people just going off the trail can damage the environment so much.
Do you know when that practice was put in place to have the established stop points?
Yeah, after I left.
Okay.
But I couldn't tell you exactly when.
And was there any kind of a permit or registration system
No.
when you were there?
No, nothing like that. And not really much of an orientation either. I mean, they would often, I think, go in and talk to the rangers in Skagway. And they almost always tried to have orientation hikes for the, you know, the interpreters who were going to talk to people at the beginning of the season so they would know what they were talking about.
Right.
But, you know, some people didn't check in, so they just took off and did the trail and did whatever, you know, they didn't know what to expect. So, but now I think they're very good about trying to really tell people what they're getting into.
Yeah, and nowadays I think, you know, you cross the border, and so nowadays I think the Canadian wardens are sort of the border patrol checking passports, or I don't quite know how that works.
No, you know, I don't know that they, maybe they've gotten really strict. I mean, we never cared about anything like that. And the border, you know, never, the border people never gave us any problem about that, you know. So, and, you know, people were just supposed to be aware they should check in at the border when they went over.
When they went back, you mean?
Right, go back to Fraser and say, I crossed.
So, and now I'm coming back.
And, yeah. But who knows if people did.
Yeah. And you weren't checking for the 1,000 pounds of goods?
No, no. Yeah.
So did you enjoy that job?
Oh, I loved that job. It was a lot of fun. It's a great job to do when your knees are healthy and your back is healthy. And, you know, if you don't have any attachments outside of working, you know, because you're basically gone for a season. I mean, you can come, you know, we used to work a 10-day shift, so we'd be in for 10, out for 4.
And you'd go back to Whitehorse in between?
Yeah, I'm usually to Whitehorse. I did for one or two seasons, I went down to Skagway. Probably after Frank and I were together, I went down to Skagway. And then another time, I kind of split my time between Skagway and Whitehorse. Because I wasn't really living in either place. So I was just staying with friends when I went out.
Yeah. And so what was the season? When did you first go out onto the trail?
We'd usually go out right around just after Victoria Day in Canada, which is about May 21st. And then we'd come back in probably by mid-September at the very latest. So we'd always be there for Labor Day weekend because that's a big hiking weekend still. But right after that, the trail traffic really drops off because the weather starts getting really unpredictable. And I mean, it can snow anytime. So.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to ask about snow conditions. May 21st to mid-September. When you went up in May, was there still snow?
Yeah, oh yeah. Our first patrols were always across big snowfields, and we'd have snowshoes, and, you know, for a long time it was walking on snow, like all the way from probably Deep Lake, when Deep Lake's about 3 miles north of Lindeman, all the way to the summit, it would be snow. So, and depending on the year, heavier snow years or lighter. But now I'm sure they don't get as much snow. You know, it doesn't stick around as long.
But they still, in their education promotion for the trail, they in their material, they still have photos of big snowfields.
Yeah, well, because people, I think that's a shock to a lot of people. It's like, oh, there's snow?
Yeah.
I have to walk on this? And it can be awful because unless you go first thing in the morning, you're going to stovepipe where your leg goes down to your hip
right.
with every step. So, you know, unless you have snowshoes or you go when there's a crust on the snow, it's awful.
Yes.
Yeah, so.
And, well, you guys, would you sort of break a trail and then that would be easier for?
Yeah, we carried these huge markers. They were tall as I am with a big bright orange flag, you know, that like a permanent plastic flag. So they would stand out pretty well in the, you know, against the snow or even in a whiteout. So we would haul those things. I mean, they weighed a ton. And we used to haul those and mark the trail. So, and we would, part of the public safety is somebody had to reset that trail every day in the snow because things are changing so fast. It's melting, the creeks are moving, and snowfields are collapsing. So you have to rework that trail every day. So
I was going to say, how did you find the trail in the beginning of the season? If it was all just snowfields and not marked, how did you know where the trail was?
The person I worked with there, Christine Hedgecock, had worked there. Oh, gee, when did Christine start working there? Probably about 1976, maybe. So she'd already been there for several years, and as far as I know, she's still there. And so Christine knew where the trail was, knew where and they would always cache markers way up high where we knew there wouldn't be snow that would stay for very long. So she knew where the trail was, you know, the first year I went, I had no idea where the trail went in the winter. But, you know, after you've done it one season, you kind of know where the trail goes.
Even if it's all covered in snow?
Mm-hmm. It's pretty, you know, there's certain landmarks, you just know where things are. And, you know, it might not be exactly where the trail is, but it's close enough,
yeah.
you know, to it that people could certainly follow the markers.
Yeah, and then get to where there's no snow.
Yeah.
And then eventually, you know, as the snow melts.
Yeah, then you move it over to exactly where the trail goes.
And so you guys just marked and followed the trail to the summit. The American side, that was all marked and maintained and patrolled by the National Park Service
right.
rangers.
Right. Yep. So, yeah, they didn't use the big markers like we did, but they would often have cairns with duct tape, or not duct tape,
like survey tape.
Yeah. And some markers, I think.
Yeah, I don't know now if they're they have those big markers.
Well, I think somebody from Parks Canada made those markers, so I don't know what they're doing now, because, you know, I don't know if somebody else was trying to replace them or not.
It didn't ever occur to me that you'd have to carry them in and move them. I kind of figured they're big markers and they're there and they're there.
Yeah, because they have to move with the conditions, so they have to be mobile. So, you know, we had huge cairns, like big Inukshuks that we had built, mm-hmm. and those would stand out eventually, but sometimes the snow was deeper than the Inukshuks,
really?
So you wouldn't see them.
And for people who don't know what an Inukshuk is, I know, but it's the piles of rocks, kind, well, sort of shaped like a human.
Yeah, or sometimes just a big cairn. Yeah. Sometimes we built like an Inukshuk human-looking yeah. thing, and sometimes they were just really big cairns.
Yeah.
We tried to build them on higher ground so they would melt out early, but sometimes they were still hard to see. So the markers were important.
Yeah. Did you guys keep track of numbers of people on the trail?
Oh, yeah.
Per year?
Yeah. Yeah, we did. Every day.
Do you remember any of that? Like how many in those first years versus the later years?
It would vary so much, you know. Earlier in the season, there would be fewer people. Typically, you know, if you'd go right up until probably almost July the 1st, you know, the big weekend, July 1st, July 4th, it wasn't that busy because there was a lot of snow, and it just didn't seem like a busier time of year. But any time July, August, it was always really busy. There were many more people. But then it would die off really fast, you know, after Labor Day.
And did you notice from, you know, 81 to 91, change in total numbers? Were there more people coming than there had been?
More Europeans. Hmm. You know, there weren't a lot of Europeans that I recall initially, but a lot of Germans. A lot of Germans.
Hmm.
I think because it became a known, you know, hiking experience, and so there were actually, you know, there were guides that we'd see every year that would bring their groups over, and a lot of individuals. And Germans are just real outdoorsy people, so mm-hmm. they seem to, you know, really want to do that kind of thing.
So were there guided hikes? There were...
Some, yeah.
Yeah?
And some were just independent.
I don't know if you can... If they still allow guides.
I don't know. You know, and there were no permits or anything, so they
yeah.
just did
and
whatever.
Were there people who, you know, like in the Gold Rush, you could pay somebody to pack your gear? Were there people who were, like, packers?
No. Not that I'm aware of. I never mm-hmm. heard about anything like that. I think there were people who wish they could have done that.
Not those things. That was a good little business to
yeah.
start. Well, as you said, you must have carried heavy packs.
Yeah, we would carry probably 20 to 30 pounds every time we would go out, because we had these huge first aid kits. I mean, the things were, my boss made them, actually, and they would roll up.
Mm-hmm.
So they had all, you know, many pockets, and you'd roll them up, but the things were like a big sleepy bag, and they probably weighed, I don't know, 15 pounds anyhow, because we had all kinds of stuff in them. And then we'd have, you know, we'd have to take some food up and water and whatever you wanted to have for clothing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but then in the beginning of the season, you said, or bringing supplies in, you guys would have to pack that in from Bennett,
well, it depends. They usually, in the early part of the time I worked there, they would fly it in by helicopter from usually from Log Cabin.
Mm-hmm.
So drive a big truck down there, and then they just sling stuff across. And then I think it probably got to be too expensive to do that, so they went with fixed-wing aircraft instead that would just fly stuff in to Lindeman.
So how often would you get resupplied with fresh food?
I'm thinking about every couple weeks. I don't think they would have done it once a week. That's too much money.
Well, I was thinking when you guys went out on to Whitehorse or Skagway on your days off, did you carry fresh things back in?
Sometimes, yeah. Most of the people were carrying their laundry. But I remember washing my clothes out there because the first year I worked there, we didn't actually take much time off, as I recall. We just kind of worked there, and then, you know, occasionally we'd walk out and go down to Skagway for the 4th of July or something. It was just a different atmosphere, you know. Everybody kind of really liked working, and we didn't really care about going out, and you just go out when you want to go out and come back. So we did a lot of laundry in there with the washboard.
Oh, is that how you... Yeah. You didn't pull a washboard off the trail, did you, and use it?
No.
Maybe. <Yeah.
laughs> Didn't find one of those.
Well, yeah, that's a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. I was young. We used to bake our own bread. We used to do a lot of stuff.
At Lindemann?
Oh, yeah. Because we had... I mean, I've used these a lot. These Coleman ovens.
Oh, yeah.
And they fit over top of a gas range. And then, you know, you can actually do pretty good baking in those if you learn how to regulate the temperature.
It fits over one of the Coleman, like, two burner?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we had propane stoves and Coleman ovens. So, yeah, we used to make our own bread. Seems unbelievably amazing to me now.
And... So how many, or I call them rangers because it's the American term, but patrol wardens?
Yeah.
How many were on the trail on the Canadian side at any one time?
Well, when I first worked there, there was a corps of four. There was the supervisor and three warden patrol people. And then they brought in a bilingual person. So there had to be, and I think that was one of the four. So one of the people had to be bilingual. And then they brought in a big archaeological crew one year. That was, well, I can't remember the exact year, but they were there for a number of years. So there was one year we had a huge crew in there. There was a bunch of archaeologists, about four of them. Then we had trail surveyors. There's about four of them. Then there was the crew on the trail, so there was four of us, plus maybe one, I think we had they call them a COSEP student, so it was like a university student that was getting environmental experience.
Like an intern?
Yeah, and they'd come out for at least a month. They were there a long time, so there were a lot of people there. There was about 15 people there.
And they were all at Lindemann?
They were all based out of Lindemann, except the Archies went up to the summit for a while. Which was good. I don't think they thought it was good, but it kind of lessened the burden down there. But we had to get a camp cook that year because we couldn't keep up with all the stuff, cooking for all those people and cleaning up.
Yeah.
It was a lot of work.
Yeah, it sounds like it would take up the whole Lindemann campground.
Well, we had a bunch of wall tents. That's how we had a cookhouse. So initially it was a cook tent. It eventually became a cookhouse. So, and that had a pretty big table, a long table, and it had a wood stove, and then it had a couple of propane, you know, burner stoves. And then there were several wall tents, so sleeping tents, and then there was a tent for the interpretive photographs. There was a tent that had most of our staples, like food staples and things. And there we had a shower set up. Inside, you know, like a little, looked like an outhouse building. Yeah, it was a pretty big camp.
So what were the archaeologists working on, do you know? What might have found?
They were basically, I think, mapping existing archaeological sites and just recording what was there. I don't think they found anything remarkable. We found something remarkable one year. I think it was my second season there. And I think we were marking the trail, and that's why this happened, because we got off the trail entirely, you know, like we were trying to find a safe way to get people up out of Happy Camp. And there was an exposed knoll, and I think we probably went up there to eat lunch or something because it was off the snow. And we found a briefcase. that somebody had dropped during the gold rush.
Wow.
And it was full of somebody's worldly goods on their way to Dawson City, and it had remember it had a set of gold scales, it had a set of candlesticks, it had a pocket watch, it had mining rules, like a book with mining rules in it. It was, oh, I think spectacles, it had, you know, he was going to miss that.
Yeah. He didn't have his name written in his briefcase.
Well, we didn't want to rummage around in it too much. So we, you know, the superficial things we looked at, but it basically got shipped out to Winnipeg, which is where Parks Canada's big office is. So I don't know whatever happened to that. I hope it got interpreted somewhere.
Well, that was my question. You know, on the American side, all the artifacts and archaeological excavations and everything goes into the Klondike Parks collections.
Right.
But what happens on the Canadian side?
I don't know. There's not really anything equivalent, which is sad. I mean, I think they feel like Whitehorse is so far away. You know, they don't set anything up there. So, and they don't have anything at Bennett.
Well, you said like that one went to Winnipeg. Why did it go to Winnipeg and not to Whitehorse?
Because that's the big regional center for, I guess, the West. So things, you know, that's where all the big archaeological crews would come out of Winnipeg, the survey crew would come out of Winnipeg.
So it would be like coming out of the Anchorage regional office.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, anything that we found, that was, you know, the place things went. So.
Yeah, well, as I say, I wonder why it didn't go to Skagway, but maybe that was too much of a relationship with Parks Canada and the U.S.
Yeah, because it was found on the Canadian side, so that's probably why. But, you know, even at the time, we thought, we really hope this comes back because it's such a unique thing to find. Yeah. But I don't know whatever happened to it.
Any other interesting things you found?
Well, you know, if you get off the beaten path a little bit, like places that people don't usually go that we would go, like where the old part of where the old Bennett City was located, you'd find lots of really cool stuff, bottles and cans with labels on them still and all kinds of things like that. And the old sheep camp, actually, the rangers there could take you over to where the old sheep camp ruins were, and there was a lot of neat old stuff over there too. But anything that was on the trail definitely got picked over. You know, yeah. Horseshoes would walk. And
even on the Canadian? Heard that for the U.S. side, but on the Canadian side?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because I had pictures of things from when I first worked there, and then when we went back this time, it's like, oh, there's nothing left.
Yeah, I don't know if some of that walked away by, you know, for preservation reasons, or if they walked away for human...
People. Probably both.
Because, I mean, certainly nowadays there's a lot of education about don't take artifacts home and leave things where you find them. But certainly in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s, I don't know that that was happening.
No. You know, there was a blacksmith shop along the trail, and you could tell it was a blacksmith shop. There were horseshoes everywhere and a forge, and, you know, you could just see that it had been a place where somebody was working on horses, and it was right at there used to be a wagon road that went through the Happy Camp Canyon, and so it was right at the end of that canyon. And all, you know, those horseshoes are gone, long gone.
Yeah. But, so they used horses on the Canadian side?
In places, yeah, where they could. So the Happy Camp Canyon, you could take, you know, for a short distance, probably from Crater Lake across Morro Lake. There's a little bit of a canyon, then Happy Camp Canyon, down to Long Lake, and then you could take a boat. And then from there, I think they had to walk. So, yeah.
Because, on the U.S. side, again, they used horses up to a point, but then you had to walk. And I didn't think about that then Canadians would have horses on the other end. To meet you, and you could hire the...
Yeah. So, you know, horses didn't do the path. Well... I don't think horses did the pass at all.
I can't imagine.
Yeah.
They did the white pass.
Yeah, they did the white pass. But you just don't, you know, somebody probably tried. But there are pictures of horses at the summit. So they probably were, you know, hauling goods down through, you know, once you get across the pass, it's a gradual walk mostly down to Lake Lindeman. But, you know, there are areas that would be really hard to bring a horse through. So.
Well, that's what I said. I think bringing a horse up the pass would have been...
would have been horrible for the poor horse.
Yeah.
But I don't think it... I don't think it happened.
Yeah, but that... but let's say I hadn't thought about that the horses could be brought in from Lindeman to meet the men at the summit and help and use them to get back down.
Yeah, so they had a, they definitely had horses. You know, whether how much they were used, I don't know.
Was there evidence of the cruelty and death of horses to the extent that happened on the White Pass?
I don't think they were used to the same extent as on the White Pass, so... you know, I'm sure they weren't well cared for, just given the conditions they were all living in. But maybe the horses on the Chilkoot were more valued because there weren't as many of them.
Maybe. Well, and also, I don't, you know, as the patrol warden, I don't know how much you learned on the history and interpreting and all that.
Yeah, I did a lot of, you know, a lot of reading because I had worked in Dawson City before I had worked there, so it was... it was cool to kind of work at both ends of where the gold rush had been.
Yeah. And was that reading everything that was just your personal interest so you would know more?
Yeah, pretty much. I don't remember, you know, I think we were probably encouraged to read, but it was, I was always interested in the gold rush history, so.
Because, yeah, I think, you know, you weren't, your job wasn't to be an interpretive ranger.
No. Yeah, it's, you know, it's different than... I guess the American Park Service, where there are people with definite assigned roles, that you are an interpreter, you are a backcountry ranger. We were kind of like everything. And but we weren't formally, you know, given, like I said, given the roles of interpreting. But we certainly fielded lots of questions.
Yeah.
You know, people wanted to know.
That's why I thought that you self-educated, because you knew you'd have to answer questions.
Yeah. And... I think all of us that worked there were all interested in it. So, oh, I know what I forgot to say about the staff, too. One of our warden patrol people always had to be a First Nations person. So we had a bilingual person, a First Nations person. I think there were five of us, because I think the bilingual person was an additional person. So, yeah, for I don't think the first year, definitely, we didn't have... First Nations are bilingual, but after that, we definitely had a bilingual person, and then probably within a year or two of that, we had a First Nations person always working with us.
And did that First Nations person have to be from that region, or could be any First Nations in Canada?
Preferably from Carcross. So that's usually where they came from. Yeah.
And the bilingual was the French-English from the Canadian government?
Yeah. You know, they didn't ever have to speak French.
But so how many hikers going across were French-speaking?
Rarely they would have to speak French, maybe. But it was just fulfilling a government mandate. So that's why they had a bilingual person.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully the people selected for those positions also had wilderness skills and trail knowledge.
They were usually pretty good people. There, one of them was a local guy from... he wasn't from Carcross, but he was from, you know, on the Carcross Road. So it wasn't really a community, but he was a trapper. So, you know, he knew lots about stuff. He was a trapper with a lot of environmental sensibilities.
Yes. Well, and they do know the area because they're out in it.
Yeah. So he was, and he was a really good guy.
And so one of my questions was about how you divided the duties between the different... patrol wardens. It sounds like you kind of all did everything?
We kind of all did everything. You know, I was the supervisor there for a couple of years, which was fun. So I think I designated certain things to certain people, projects for them to do, you know. But we all still shared the communal duties of patrolling and, you know, doing all the work we had to do. And later on, the Parks Canada also hired trail maintenance crew, and they were mostly guys out of Carcross mostly First Nation guys. So all the work that we had done, you know, trail clearing and bridge repair and all that kind of stuff, they did.
So you had to do all of that at the beginning.
Oh, yeah. We did all that. Moving big rocks, digging outhouse pits. I did it all. Bucked all the firewood.
Wow. So you said you had projects for the people to work on. What are some of those kinds of projects?
Oh, they weren't anything big, but, you know, I wanted somebody to, I remember what I assigned myself. I had to go and record all the artifacts and photograph them and then put compass bearings on them so people could find them, because I knew where they all were, so right. I wanted to record all that. I had somebody, we had a lot of airplane traffic that went over, so we wanted to kind of record who was going over and, you know, if they were flying particularly low and how long they were flying and that kind of thing. I think we had to put up a bunch of interpretive signs, so they were these huge metal signs, ridiculous, and they all had to be carried by a person out to these places on the trail, so I gave that to one person to do.
I would think that would take a couple people to carry those.
He it was a guy. He was strong, and he didn't mind doing that. But that, you know, that took him all summer to move those signs around. Just stuff like that.
And then he had to install the signs.
Yeah.
Which means digging a hole and putting in the foundation. I don't know.
Well, often they would dig a hole and then fill it with rocks, you know, instead of, because we didn't really do cement. So
yeah.
Stuff like that. You know, painting jobs, all that kind of stuff that has to, you know, there's a lot of maintenance that has to happen. So.
Yeah, and I guess there was free time to do that.
Well, yeah, I mean, because, you know, basically there was one or two people who would be doing a patrol. So that would mean, you know, between one and three people were available to do other things. So, yeah.
Do you remember when you got the maintenance crew?
Oh, gee. It wasn't until probably, let's see, I finished in 91. I would say about 1987, maybe. Let's see. Might have been a little bit earlier than that. Might have been even 85, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did they have special assignments? Like, this year we're going to work on this part?
I would say it was a little more loose than that. So, the crews that we had later, you know, before I left, they were really good. They were really hardworking guys, and they definitely had specific things they wanted to get done, and they did them. You know, like they would do big sections of the trail, put in, you know, areas that were muddy, they put walkways over it, and they did a really good job. The guys that we had earlier were not so good, so they, you know, there was kind of always a struggle to get them to do the work they were supposed to do.
And now, did you have any authority over them to say, hey, you're
doing I wasn't. This? I wasn't the boss then. So my boss at the time was not an effective boss.
Well, so the boss, the supervisor on the trail, oversaw the maintenance crew. They didn't have their own boss.
They did. They had I would say they didn't. The later on, the later crew did. They definitely had a trail boss, but the earlier guys kind of answered to my boss.
Right.
So it was a little too loosey-goosey.
Are there bridges on the Canadian side that need to be built, maintained? Because I know that's a big issue on the American side.
Yeah, not we don't have like the bridges like, you know, Jerry Watson put in. Those are amazing. There's a bridge at Lindeman, and there's a bridge at Deep Lake. Those are the two big bridges. So, and back in the day, they were, you know, really makeshift, because they had a real early crew that, you know, found the trail and then marked the trail and built the bridges and built the log cabins. And they were there in the early 70s. Frank probably has that all written down in his book. I can't remember. Anyhow, it was, they were part of a kind of a youth group. So it was a bunch of young kids and couple of adults and they did all this work.
Well, I know that that was the case in the U.S. side.
Mm-hmm. It's probably the same.
Did they went all the way over onto the Canadian side?
They must have done.
I don't know. We have to look it up in Frank's book.
Yeah, it would be in Frank's book. Anyhow, they built the original bridges that were still there when I worked there, so they did a really good job, but yeah. They have been replaced. So eventually they just wore out.
Mm-hmm. Besides Christine, do you remember the names of any of the other people you worked with?
The first year I worked there, it was Debbie Tozak, and then Tom. I can't remember Tom's last name. And Christine and I worked together for many years. She wasn't there. I think I was the boss there in 88, maybe in 89. So she was consistent. One of the Native First Nations guys with Danny Cresswell. I worked with him for many years. He was there for a long, long time. Mark. Mark's last name. He was one of the bilingual guys. Can't think of his last name. It's in Frank's book. Richard, he was another one of the bilingual guys. Bill Overend, he was one of the guys I worked with out there.
Starting in 1981, I wouldn't think there would have been too many women doing trail work.
Yeah,
being trail rangers or wardens.
Yeah, I think we were pretty unique. I mean, there were definitely were not many women in the warden service.
Right.
In fact, Debbie Tozak, who became Debbie Verhall, was one of the first women to go into the warden service. And in fact, after she finished working on the Chilkoot, she went off to become a park warden. She went down to Riding Mountain National Park, which is a big training center for wardens, and became a park warden, one of the first women.
And that's like being a superintendent?
No, that's like being a park warden. So there really were not women in the warden service. So she was a real trailblazer.
Mm-hmm.
And Christine, my boss, also went down to become a warden, but she really wasn't cut out for that kind of work. So she didn't become a park warden. So she stayed as a warden patrol person.
So what does being a warden entail? What kind of duties does one have?
Well, park wardens, they, you know, will have more law enforcement ability. So they're going to work in some of the really big parks and do all that kind of stuff. They're going to do a lot of wildlife management and land management. And the wardens in the big park in the Yukon is Kluane. And so they're, one of their big things is they do a lot of the high mountain rescue stuff. So, yeah. But I think we got a lot of respect from those guys because we had to work with them a little bit, you know, to do some cooperative training and things. And I think they thought we were just, you know, little women running mm-hmm. around out on that trail that doesn't mean anything, but we were pretty tough.
Yeah, I would think so. Do you remember, were there women on the U.S. side?
Yeah, there were.
When you started?
Christy Heron was over there. I think she was the only female. There was always, almost always, I think there was only maybe one year there were no women. There were almost always at least one woman working on the U.S. side.
Mm-hmm. And did you, like at the beginning of the season, did the U.S. Rangers and you guys in Canada, did you all get together for a meeting and meet each other? And
yeah, actually for a number of years we did training for rough terrain rescue and avalanche rescue stuff. So we would usually hire an avalanche or rough terrain rescue specialist, and then we'd all get together, usually do something in the White Pass, or not usually out on the Chilkoot because it was too hard to get in and out of there, but the White Pass because it has road, it's easy.
Right.
So like Doug Fessler was one of the ones we hired, and Hector McKenzie, and so they would, you know, we'd learn how to use ropes and how to, you know, get people onto litters and move litters through rough terrain, and you know, avalanche prediction and you know, how to rescue people if they're caught in an avalanche, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, we did that for a number of years. So yeah, we tried to work pretty closely with them.
And but on the Canadian side, are there places where there's avalanche risk?
Actually, yeah, there was a huge avalanche that didn't kill anybody, but it could certainly could have. It came down right around, just below Stone Crib, right along Crater Lake. Early in the season, so we were not out on the trail yet, but we walked through the avalanche debris, so it was still pretty fresh. That was probably about 1984, I would say. So that was really scary, and after that happened, yeah. Like, everybody red alert. You know, the avalanches happen here.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about it on the U.S. side, with the, you know, coming up the scales and right. The summit and all that.
Yeah, well, that's historically where there's a big risk, but there hasn't been anything since. I mean, there's always little avalanches that you can see coming right. down, but yeah, that was a bit scary.
But so, yeah, there were none on the American side that were potential dangers while you were there.
No.
So you guys did all that training and you never needed to rescue anybody.
No, thankfully.
Yeah, I wondered how if you got to know the American Rangers other than just on the radio.
Yeah, we did. I mean, some of them better than others. Some were more, had more, you know, ability to communicate and were more personable. But, yeah, mostly we, you know, whenever we would go into Skagway, if anybody was in town, yeah, we'd get together and see them. So, yeah, we got to know them, you know, some of them pretty well.
Did they ever walk out the Canadian way and you'd see them on the trail?
Oh, yeah. They'd come always come and stay at Lindeman. And often, like I said, the interpreters would always do a walk through, you know, and they'd come and stay. And lots of times the rangers would come, too. So, yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, it seems shorter to go out the American way. But...
Well, they wouldn't do that routinely, but, you know, sometimes they just, like a family member would come and visit and they just hike the trail, you know, and so they'd come over or they want to just see the Canadian side because they hadn't seen it, so they just walk out that way.
And did, I'm going to say it, doing all that hiking back and forth from Lindeman to the summit and Mount Bennett, did you get tired of doing the trail?
Never the Canadian side because it's just so beautiful. I mean, that's my favorite kind of country. It's all above tree line and, you know, until you get down to Lindeman. And it's stunning. I mean, it's just beautiful, those big alpine lakes up there. And you spend, you know, when you're up at Stone Crib, if you're up there by yourself, I mean, you're up there and there's nobody else around for a long, long way. It's beautiful. But I got tired of the American side, I have to say, because it's, you know, it's a rainforest. It's beautiful. I grew up in a rainforest, so it wasn't anything new for me. Just never was my favorite to go through there. But I certainly hiked it many, many times.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Yep.
So if you had a day off and you were going to go to Skagway, did you hike down?
No.
No.
Never. Maybe once or twice.
You hiked out to the road. And
yeah. But, you know, we would, one year we had a bunch of Girl Scouts come through. So they were coming with, I guess they just, you know, a big group wanted to come through. So they contacted us to see if one of us could help, you know, with, I guess, just come through on the hike with them. So I did that. That was really fun. And I don't know, for various reasons, I remember going up and down that trail on the U.S. side. I think a few times, actually, they didn't have any rangers available for whatever reason. So Debbie Tozak and I went down to Sheep Camp and were sort of the stand-in rangers for a few days.
So you hiked down from the summit?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not very much fun to go down that pass.
No, I wouldn't think so.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if it's raining and slippery.
Yeah. It's never advisable, but...
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking also, you know, back and forth on the trail with heavy packs, that gets old.
Yeah, I never minded. I mean, you know, nobody likes to hike 10 miles in the rain, and we did that a lot. We'd hike 10 miles in the horizontal rain, but we always knew we had a place that we could at least get in out of the weather at the, you know, at the top, and we always had a little kerosene heater there, so could huddle around the heater.
But luxury.
Yeah, felt like it.
So what do you think you gained from that experience of all those years on the trail?
Well, I think I learned that I could really be very self-reliant. And I think I learned, I got a real deep appreciation for the wilderness. And for hiking, I mean, I still love to hike. Mm-hmm. I met two husbands there.
Did you meet Frank on the trail?
No, I met him in Skagway. Yeah, pretty funny, because when, you know, we would come down into town and meet all the interpreters. So I remember definitely coming down for a meeting with all the interpreters so we could all meet, and the rangers and everybody. And I hadn't met Frank, but everybody said, "Hey, have you met the guy who drives to work?"
In Skagway?
It's Frank. He's from California, right? So he used to drive. He used to have the little blue Toyota truck, and he used to drive, like, you know, like 8 blocks in Skagway, maybe, to work. Well, no, I haven't met him.
Well, in the winter, when that wind is blowing off those glaciers, I could kind of see why you might want to drive to work.
But this is summer. No excuse. He was just, I don't know.
But so that's how you met him.
Yeah, we just met. Well, I was married at the time, and so we were friends. And then my first husband actually drowned up in the Yukon.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, that was a long, long time ago. Yeah. So, yeah, then things changed.
Life does that.
Life does that.
Yeah, you must have enjoyed the outdoors to keep going back every summer.
Yeah, it was just such a unique lifestyle. You know, you could... it was a lot of freedom. And that was pretty nice. You know, the managers in Whitehorse, you know, just trusted that we would do a good job, and we did, you know. And so they didn't really interfere with how things were run.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. What kind of a management oversight would...
Well, initially it was the park superintendent out of Whitehorse. And there, you know, I had how many different superintendents? Bruce Harvey, Bob Lewis, Mike Murphy. Mike Murphy was terrible. Hope he's not still alive. Read this. But, you know, they were all good superintendents. I mean, and they just trusted that the trail supervisor, who was Christine, you know, knew what she was doing, and they didn't really interfere with how things were run out there, which... mostly worked out. And then later on, they brought in a park warden who oversaw the work of the warden patrol people. And that was Jim McIntyre and Tom Elliott. And I think they were the only two that I recall. So they were a little more involved. You know, they would kind of want to make sure that there were certain things they wanted us to accomplish. And but it was still pretty loose oversight, I would say.
Can you remember what some of those things they wanted you to accomplish?
Tom Elliott was the one who wanted all the warden patrol people to make sure they camped in all of the campsites at some point in the summer for at least one or two nights, just to have a higher visitor awareness and presence. And when Tom was there, it was the years we were, I think we had that huge crew. So there was a lot of just trying to manage the numbers, mm-hmm. and trying to keep that all organized.
You mentioned one superintendent who was not so good.
No.
Can you give a general description of what was not so good?
I think he was just a professional bureaucrat, and he was definitely on his way to bigger things. So I think the Chilkoot wasn't an important place for him. You know, he went to Nahanni, which is a big park in the Northwest Territories, or he came from Nahanni. And then I think I heard he went off, you know, to bigger things bureaucratically. So, you know, I just don't think he really cared.
So by being interested in being a bureaucrat, did he institute lots of procedures and rules and things you guys had to do out on the trail?
No, he just had no idea what we did, you know, and he didn't really care to know. So.
Yeah. I was going to ask something else, but I wrote a note to myself about getting along with people. So being out there for months at a time with a crew of 4 to 6 people, how did that work?
Mostly it worked pretty well. You know, there were certainly some people that came out there that weren't a good fit. And typically they didn't come back after one season, you know. But, you know, part of the, well, it's hard to say. I mean, I worked with a lot of men. I find men are easier to work with, typically, than women. Although the women that I worked with were, you know, pretty direct, good communicators, no passive-aggressive crap. And with men, you know, you can just tell them, you know, you're being an asshole, so you should stop. And they'll say, oh, okay.
But it's having, being a woman, having the courage to say that. That's
enough. Oh, I never had any issue with that. It's like, you're crossing this line, and that's not okay. So, yeah, no, I mean, there were some people I didn't care to be around, but for the most part, I don't have bad feelings about anybody.
And if there were people who were difficult or didn't want to be around, was there a way you could separate, and did you have to be up at the summit with them in the little cabin for 4 days?
No, that usually didn't happen, because you could at least say, you know, I'd really rather do that myself than with this person. And then we had our own sleeping quarters. I mean, for the first couple of years, I think Debbie and I shared a tent, and then we actually got our own sleeping tent. So that was nice, because you actually had your own little space you could be around yourself. And then so, you know, mostly we had communal meals. If whoever was in camp, usually somebody would cook and somebody would clean up. And so, but, you know, sometimes you were the only person in camp, so you just take care of yourself.
See, I keep thinking of these things I'm forgetting. Before you had mentioned about having a tent where you kept food supplies.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering about bear activity and protecting your resources from bears.
Yeah, well, we had a pretty limited meat diet and, you know, a little bit of meat. But we were very careful about how we would dispose of anything. And we had all of our food that was potentially able to be, you know, attacked by mice or squirrels or anything, we would have it in great big boxes, like wooden boxes. So you could put all your nuts and raisins and cereals and all that in there so the mice couldn't get at it. And then we had a small fridge.
Oh.
And then, because we had propane.
Fancy schmancy.
Yeah. And then we actually had, it didn't work that well, but we had some storage in one of the docks so that they were, you know, big floating compartments in the docks, so and plastic containers could go in there and stay cold because the lake was cold.
Yeah.
And then we had some cold storage in the creek, so we had a big garbage can that we could sink, you know, hold it down with rocks and put stuff in there and keep it cold.
That's where you kept your beer.
Well, no beer. No alcohol.
No, I'm kidding, because that's what I've done camp, you know, on a raft trip to camping. Yeah, you put the beer in the creek.
Yeah, so we were, you know, very careful. We never had any bad bear issues at all, actually.
Are the bears maybe more of a problem on the U.S. side?
Probably, yeah. I mean, we certainly saw bears. I mean, we saw grizzly bear and black bear, but they never came into our camp because we were always really careful. And, you know, any food, mostly we burned all of our garbage and... really, we had very little that would be hanging around that would be an attractant for a bear.
And did you have to teach hikers about proper bear safety and food storage mm-hmm. and camping?
We did a lot of that, yeah. Because people are very bad and they want to throw their garbage down in the outhouse holes and dumb things like that. So
and, you know, about not keeping food in their tents yeah. and things like that.
So, you know, we would always try to educate people about stuff like that. Especially if you're coming, you know, usually the person who was coming down from the summit, if they'd done a patrol and spent several days, would be coming through toward evening because, you know, the days are late. So right. you'd be coming down maybe by 7 or 8 o'clock at night. And so you'd come through where people are camping, you know, and they're cooking and doing whatever. So you can make sure they're doing the right things.
You'd make a little detour through the campground.
Oh, yeah. Always check on people. Make sure they're not throwing their stuff in the creek or down the outhouse or pouring their bacon grease on the rocks or whatever, you know.
Well, it's funny. I was at the Seattle unit a couple weeks ago and looking at their exhibits, and they have, you know, the classic list of things the stampeders needed to take.
Oh, yeah.
And one was 150 pounds of bacon.
Bacon.
And I'm like, what? In bear country? No, thank you.
Well, I guess because it was winter.
It wasn't maybe always winter.
No, but that.
I mean, that's what people ate back then.
Yeah.
They needed the bacon, but there clearly was, back then, not quite the same bear safety issues.
No. Well, they just shot them, right? They didn't care.
Which, that was one of my questions, was did you, on the Canadian side, were you carrying a weapon?
No. Never.
I don't know if the U.S. Rangers.
No. At least in the past, they weren't law enforcement.
The trail rangers are not law enforcement.
Well, There were definitely rangers who had law enforcement background who worked over there, and some yeah. of them were jerks. I remember them. but they were not allowed to carry a weapon.
The regular rangers?
Nobody carried a weapon.
Even the law enforcement rangers, if they came onto the trail, no weapon?
No weapon.
Why?
I don't know. I just think that's the way they made the rules over there.
On both sides?
Well, there were no law enforcement people on our side. Now, I don't know if that's changed, because now they have a warden who's involved. Maybe he carries a weapon, I don't know.
Yeah, because
I can't, there's no need for it, typically. Right. I mean, you know, the worst thing people are doing is trying to burn an artifact or something. You know, they're just not doing bad, really bad things.
Right.
So.
Well, and of course, nowadays, it's the crossing the border with a weapon is not
a really bad thing.
Yeah, it's yeah. not really allowed. So
yeah.
Certainly for hikers, that would be problematic. Did hikers carry weapons for bear protection?
Not that I can ever recall. You know, maybe they had something hidden in their backpack, but
right.
yeah.
Then it doesn't really do you very much good.
No, so but no, I don't recall. I mean, people would have pepper spray and you know, air horns and mm-hmm. things like that, but I never saw anything other than that.
Yeah. And so, one of my questions, you had mentioned that the park superintendent was in Whitehorse.
Right.
So, you know, I know the American side is the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park. What's the Canadian side?
Well, it's, you mean the name of the
park on the Canadian, I mean,
oh, it's the Chilkoot Trail National Historic Site.
Okay. And that's just the corridor then?
It's just the corridor, yeah. And it may take in, you know, because of the First Nations component, there may be more now around Bennett Carcross, because that's the First Nations people, you know, that this is part of their traditional land. So that's all stuff that has since been put in place.
Mm-hmm. Well, then I can't remember the year. At some point, it became an international park with the sort of the two units.
Right, 98.
Is that when it was?
Yeah.
So were you involved in any of that? No, that was after you left.
It was after we left. We were living in Anchorage at that time, and we were asked to come back. So we came for the ceremony that was at Bennett. And it was just a pretty, it was a fun day. We all took the train up from Skagway. It was Debbie, well, at the time, Debbie Verhall, because she got married, and myself and Danny Cresswell, I don't know. There might have been some of the other trail maintenance guys from Carcross that were out there for that. And there was a little ceremony out at Bennett and, you know, speeches and all that kind of stuff. That was fun.
So you weren't privy to any of those negotiations and decision-making about it becoming an international park?
No, not at all.
Do you think it makes any difference?
Well, I just think it formalizes the, you know, the informal way that we were always doing the work, you know, that we worked cooperatively with the rangers and chief park warden over, or ranger on the other side, you know, so.
Yeah, so the chief ranger on the American side worked closely with the park warden.
Well, not really, actually, not that I'm aware of. They might now. But back in the day, they kind of worked really closely with the supervisor, so, or with the superintendent. So the supervisor on the trail, or, you know, with the superintendent in Whitehorse. But, you know, because his work had so much to do with what we were doing on the trail, so right. He needed to know, you know, what we were doing on the trail.
Right, but the U.S. Ranger, Chief Ranger, didn't necessarily need to know what you guys were doing on your part of the trail? Is that
no,
what you mean?
But he, like Jay Cable was really pretty hands-on. He always hiked the trail at least once and probably many more than one time a year. And, you know, we dealt with him a lot, just, you know, over, you know, if there were any emergency situations or, you know, radio stuff. You know, he was always the point man for all that.
And so. After he left?
Well, he left after we left.
Oh, okay.
So, I don't know.
Oh.
Yeah.
I was also thinking all this hiking back and forth. I'm assuming you were in a Parks Canada uniform all the time?
Yeah, we didn't get to wear the full warden patrol or the warden outfit because we weren't wardens. So that we got shirts that said park warden, garde de parc, which is the French version. But we couldn't wear the hat with the insignia. And we couldn't wear there were some other things. We could only wear pieces of the uniform, so mostly the shirt.
Well, I'm seeing that might be better. I don't know about Parks Canada uniforms, but U.S. uniforms
are pretty impractical.
Yes, I was thinking for hiking, they're not very practical.
No, and, you know, mostly we were hiking in rain gear or long underwear and shorts.
Yeah.
And that, you know, we had the shirt, and then often we were wearing a fleece over that, which I don't think we had an insignia on that fleece, but we had a raincoat that had a garde de parc thing on the shoulders.
So you were identifiable in some way.
Yeah.
Because that's what I was thinking, like hiking the trail in a Park Service uniform does
not
sound fun.
And they did it.
And I mean, nowadays a Park Service trail uniform might be more practical, but I don't know.
I don't think so. There's still the horrible green jeans and polyester shirts. And
yeah. But you could be more flexible in what you wore.
Yeah, because we weren't officially wardens. If we were officially wardens, we probably would have had to wear more official.
But you were officially trail wardens or patrol or something. You were still official.
Yeah, we were official, but we weren't wardens. So it's a little more loose.
Does that make a difference in the Parks Canada hierarchy?
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
It's very hierarchical.
Very hierarchical. Yeah. So.
And did you ever have any interest in moving up into that hierarchy instead of just being a seasonal trail person?
I did. You know, I definitely toyed with the idea of going into the warden service. I think I would have enjoyed it, you know. But it was right at the time when Frank and I were getting together, and I just knew if I went down that path, it was going to be challenging to try to have a life with somebody that was an American.
Well, in an American Park Service.
Yeah.
It's hard, so, really hard to get stationed in a boundary park so you could each be on your
side.
Yeah,
so I had always wanted to pursue nursing, so I did that instead. But
well, and you sort of, you know, trail rescue and first aid gave you a sense of that, I guess.
Oh, yeah. I don't have any regrets. I mean, I worked as a nurse practitioner for 25 years, so.
It's good.
Yeah.
Why did you stay with the Parks Canada Chilkoot Trail for, you know, 10 years? That's a long time. I mean, a lot of people didn't last that long.
Yeah. I just really love the work. And, you know, when we would fly out there every spring, it was just like, I don't know, just like I'm home. That's how it felt. It was just such a great place to be. And it did feel like home. It's still a very special place.
Well, 10 summers, that's a long time.
Mm-hmm. And Frank and I skied out there once in the wintertime. We went out to Lindeman. So that was fun.
From Bennett?
Yeah, we must have skied the tracks and then came in through Bennett. Skied across Lake Lindeman.
I've never thought about that. People used it in the wintertime.
Oh, yeah, and we stayed in one of the cabins. There are two cabins. I mean, they're sound cabins for winter use. They have two nice wood stoves, and there's usually a big pile of wood because it's sitting there from the summer. So, yeah, it's quite nice.
Nice. Were there particular things that that were difficult about the job?
I don't know what would have been difficult. I mean, there were seasons that were more challenging than others. The season with all those people was challenging because just the logistics was terrible. And then there was one person that was working there that was just a pain, a bad, very bad fit. And they did not come back.
But you couldn't get rid of them during the season?
I wasn't the boss, so no. But, you know, for the most part, no, I can't really think of a lot of things that I found. I mean, maybe being far away, I don't know, but I don't really think so.
The 10 miles in the rain every day.
Yeah, I mean, you know, probably, you know, on any given day, if it was a really crappy weather day and you had to walk up, you know, against the wind all day, I probably wouldn't have been the most happy camper on the planet, but.
And how did you feel about interacting with the public and the visitors?
Oh, I liked, usually, the visitors were usually pretty interesting. They were always, not always, but often just, you know, especially if it was sunny weather, they were all having a great time. If the weather was terrible, you know, it was nice to help people kind of have a better experience. So what we always did is, as a greeting, was we would always get people to stop either at Stone Cripple when we were there or at the summit. We'd always have them come in so we could assess them, and we'd always give them hot lemonade. So it was a way to make sure that they weren't hypothermic and make sure that they could warm up for a little bit and have a little bit of sugar, you know, eat a snack and have some hot lemonade before they headed out into the weather again.
And what a friendly way to greet people into Canada.
Yeah, I think they still do that.
With hot lemonade.
Yeah, yeah. People always commented on that, you know, that it was such a nice way to cross the border.
Did you guys have a guest book or anything?
At Lindeman.
Okay.
Yeah, there were. Well, there used to be lots of guest books.
What do you know what happened to those?
No. You could, if you ever get a chance, talk to Christine Hedgecock.
She's on the list.
Yeah, because she might know. Because, you know, a lot of the things that were put in place were her ideas. I'm sure the guest books were her ideas. So she may have kept them.
Well, it just fits with the question, the collections of stuff. You know, the U.S. Klondike Park is so focused on collecting and having the artifacts, and they did all the archaeology both on the trail and under the buildings. And so that's the kind of an item that I would go, oh, well, that's an archival thing. It should be preserved someplace.
It should, but who knows?
And same on the celebration for the International Park. There must be material for that, but that might be at the Klondike.
That might
since
be,
since it was a joint activity. What did you do in the winters for those 10 years?
Oh, I traveled, I went to school, just whatever. Had lots of fun.
So you didn't stay in Whitehorse? And...
Sometimes, yeah. 1 year I lived in a little cabin out of Carcross. So, yeah, I did lots of different things.
So school, was that you were you, did you get a degree in the outdoor recreation management?
No, I didn't finish it. So, no, I went back to nursing school.
You already started going back to nursing school. Okay, and why did you decide in 91 to stop doing this?
Because I got my nursing degree.
Okay.
That was it. So I got a real job.
And where, in Skagway?
No, in Anchorage.
Oh, okay. That's right. So by then you and Frank were together? And...
Yeah, we got married in 1988.
Okay.
So.
So for a few years, you did your summers on the Canadian side from Skagway? Were you living in Skagway?
1 year, when Frank and I first got together, yeah. Well, we were in Skagway, and then we actually went overseas to travel for a while. Then we came back. And then I guess because Frank actually got one of the ranger cabins out in Dyea for us to stay in that summer. So I guess we stayed there, you know, it's like seasonal quarters. So yeah, I guess I was based out of, Dyea that summer.
Right, but you were still a Canadian resident or citizen, so you could be hired by Parks Canada.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I'm assuming they only hire Canadian citizens, probably.
As far as I know, unless you're a permanent resident, yeah.
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 Do you know why when you now make a reservation to hike the trail, it's all done through Parks Canada?
I don't know why, but I know they have a little building set up right across the street from the Klondike Gold Rush.
Right, but to make a reservation, to get a permit for the trail, it's all done through Parks Canada.
Right, and that's their outpost
Yeah.
So you can probably do it online, but you can't do it online. You have to go in person.
No, you have to phone.
Oh, you have to phone. Oh, that's weird. Mm-hmm. But in the summer, they're set up.
Right, I know, and that's where you go to pick up your permit and everything, but the whole reservation system is all done through Parks Canada by phone. I didn't know if you had any idea why Parks Canada, instead of the U.S. Park Service, when you're starting on the U.S. side for the most part.
I have no idea.
Okay.
You know, maybe the other person you might want to talk to, because he would know a lot about this, is Dan Verhaal. And his wife, Debbie Verhaal, was Debbie Tozak. Mm-hmm. So Debbie has, you know, Debbie didn't work there as long as I did, but she worked there a lot of years. And she worked there for years after I left.
Okay. Yeah, I just didn't know if that was, transition was happening in the years you were on the trail.
No, but Dan was very involved in getting that permit system established.
Okay.
So he would know about that.
Okay.
So they're in Whitehorse.
Okay.
Actually, I have a phone number.
When we're done. Is there anything else that you want to share that when you broach the subject of doing this interview that particular memories have come to mind?
Oh, there are just so many. I keep thinking I'm going to write just a little recollection before they're all gone, you know, and I look at all my pictures. It was just such a wonderful experience all the years I worked there, you know, that, you know, nobody said, well, you can't do that because you're a woman. You know, it's like, you will do this because you're working here. So, you know, you're going to work and you're going to cut firewood and you're going to hook slings under helicopters and you're going to, you know, brush trails, get rid of all the, you know, the overgrowth on trails, and you're going to rescue people and do all that stuff. And it's like, I did it.
You didn't have to ever carry anybody out, did you?
No, thankfully.
Yeah.
I got, oh, well, there were some funny, many funny things. There was the year the surveyors were there. They were funny guys. Like, they were just really a bunch of jokesters. And they came up from Winnipeg. And, you know, when these guys come up from Winnipeg, it's like they want to party, right? There's no alcohol, though, so they can't party. So you have to have, like, you know, do these silly things that are just fun. So we dressed one of them up as the queen of the Chilkoot. So we dressed them all up in a, I don't know what we put them in, I think a space blanket, and put a banner across them. And rolled them around in Lindemann in a wheelbarrow and took pictures.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, it does show, you know, a little bit of, it's sort of like cabin fever.
It's a little bit like cabin fever, yeah.
That silliness ensues at some point.
Yeah, there were just lots of fun, lots and lots of fun times.
And so, may I ask what age you were in those times?
Let's see, I was... How old was I when I started there? I would have been 81, so I would have been, I have to figure it out, 24? Yeah, I guess I was 24, 23
so to 33. To 33, okay. Just gives a sense of the being young and strong and I'll do anything.
Yeah, I never felt like there wasn't anything I couldn't do. You know, and that just reaffirmed it for me.
Yeah. Well, and as you say, that it gives you that sense that, oh, I really can do anything I want to do.
Yeah. And one year we had a music, a music celebration. We brought people up from Skagway and Haines and actually had a musical gathering out there. Like we had a stage, an impromptu stage set up. I don't remember. Christine would remember all this.
And that was at Lindemann?
It was at Lindemann, yeah. And so, you know, it was, some people came out from Whitehorse. A lot of it was hikers. And I remember the weather was just terrible. So that really wasn't so great.
Well, I can imagine for a hiker and you're just beaten and weathered and to come to Lindemann and there's like live music.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was just like singer-songwriters.
And
I think it was actually a storytelling event too, so we had First Nations storytellers and then singer-songwriters, and I remember we fed a bunch of people, and you know, it was quite a deal.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about First Nations, so on the Canadian side, is the story of the trail in the context of First Nations people, is that story represented, do you feel?
When I worked there, I would say not so much. You know, not to any great degree. And I think that has changed substantially. I mean, they were certainly aware that that was a shortcoming and that was part of the reason to have the First Nations person working there so that he could or she could represent, you know, their point of view. If anybody cared to ask, which, well, I don't know if people did or not.
Well, you know... Now, I don't know if then, but, you know, the story is, you know, it was an Indian Tlingit trail, and who controlled the trail, and then during the Gold Rush, they were hired as packers. That's all the U.S. side.
Right.
I don't know if that continues into the Canadian side.
Well, you know, it wasn't ever really interpreted. I mean, there's a trapper's cabin down at Bennett that belonged to Edna Helm, who was the chief at the Carcross Indian band. I'm sure Edna's long gone.
Oh, yeah.
She was, you know, quite old back then.
Yeah.
So, you know, that trapper's cabin is still there, unless it's burned down. It was right below the church. And so, you know, they still were trapping the area. So their presence is still there.
Yeah.
But, you know, there wasn't really anything done to interpret that. The person who's done a lot of the work along that line is Dave Neufeld.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he would know a lot more.
Okay. Yeah, I just was wondering how much Parks Canada focused on that. And I mean, I don't know enough of the history of the trail. So you hear it all on the American side. I don't know if the First Nations people on the Canadian side did similar packing and how that trail and stampede affected their lives.
Well, I'm sure it affected it incredibly.
I would think
especially
so.
Especially in Carcross. But... you know, I don't know that was ever discussed. You know, did they do the same kind of work? I would say not. You know, once they got up to the summit, there were other ways to move your goods. You know, you could probably hire a horse to pull a sleigh to mm-hmm. get it down. You could pack it. I have a sense that they used horses quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, and then as you say, they, at Bennett Lake, they built their boats and were on their way.
Right. Or Lindeman. Or sometimes Lindeman. They did.
Some of they did it at Lindeman too.
A little bit, not as much, because there were rapids between Lindeman and Bennett. So, but there is at least one death recorded of somebody that went through the rapids.
I would think there'd be those boats. I think there'd be a lot of deaths with those yeah. stampeders.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that's a good question though. I don't know how much of that Dave knew. He was supposed to be doing a lot more of that kind of work as far as First Nations people, but I don't know exactly what he did.
And he's sort of the historian for the Parks Canada side,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. So. Okay. Well, unless you have anything else, any other fun stories that come to mind?
Yeah. I remember one. I always remember this older couple, and we heard about them from the American Rangers. And they said, "Oh, there's this older couple coming, and they're pretty old." And they basically, I remember, this was like probably 1982. And, you know, we were hearing reports about them coming. And then once they got to the summit, you know, we met with, I remember meeting with Christy Heron. And she said, "Okay, they're all yours now." There was no way, like they had moved like maybe 3 miles a day. They were taking a long time to get up and over. So they made it up to the pass. And then we had them at Stone Crib, and then, you know, we camped. We had them camp in all the illegal spots because there was no way they could go very far. So we were, you know, we interacted with them for, oh, probably a good 10 days, you know, and they were the sweetest people. They were about, you know, now I think of it, they weren't that old. They were probably 70 and 68, something like that, husband and wife. And he said, "Oh, I was so worried they wouldn't let me come across the trail because of my age that I put black shoe polish in my hair." So, and they were just really sweet.
Neat. So you keep talking about Stone Crib. What was that?
Well, Stone Crib was the anchor for the tramway that went up to the summit. So they would also, you know, there's this big, it looks like a crib of, it's not there anymore, it's all fallen down. When I first worked there, it was not logs, they were like milled beams that built a crib, and then they filled it with rocks.
Okay.
And that was, there was a cable that would come from the summit and sling goods down to Crater Lake, so that was the anchor for this cable. And so it was called Stone Crib, and that's where we had our initial cabins. We had our little shack that we stayed in, and right next door we had a little A-frame that the people would stay in.
And so it's below the summit?
It's below the summit about a quarter mile.
So before, if you're coming up over the summit, then Stone Crib, then you'd get to Happy Camp. It's sort of between?
Right. It's just right below the summit.
Okay.
Like, you know, you would see it from the summit. It's okay. That close. Yeah.
I just never heard, you know, I've heard all the places along the trail, the Happy Camp, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, so
but Stone, I hadn't heard Stone Crib.
Yeah, Stone Crib was our outpost for a number of years. It was only the last, I think it was about 1988, they put up the new building at the summit, which okay. seemed like a palace compared to what we had. It was quite big. So there's a facility for the warden patrol people to stay in, plus there's another little place for the warden or for the hikers to
right.
go into.
Okay. Okay. So yeah, that older couple, did Christine, did she hike all the way up to the summit with them?
Christy, yeah, she did. And then we would, you know, we pretty much had to kind of handhold them the whole way out because it was either that or we were going to have to fly them out because there was no way they were going to make it otherwise.
Well, I didn't realize that the Rangers kept such track of people.
Well, we did back in the day, you know, certainly. And there was one guy, I always remember him coming. I was up there by myself, and this is when we were still at Stone Crib. And I heard from the American Rangers, "Oh, there's still one more coming." And it was a brutal day. It was pouring rain, sideways rain, white out. I said, and they said, you know, I think the ranger had left him at the summit and he was just making his way down to Stone Crib. So I'm sitting there waiting for this guy and it was getting dark. And I thought, I don't want to go out there and have to find you. But he showed up. He showed up, of all things. And so I made sure, you know, I said, you're staying the night here. So, you know, we'll just get you dried out. Here's some hot lemonade and, you know, you'll be fine. Tomorrow morning we'll see how the weather is and you get going down the road. So anyhow, he made it and I saw him again down at Lindemann and he was doing okay. And then for the longest time afterward, I don't know how he got my address, but I was living in Seattle at the time and he would write me letters.
So you almost met a third husband.
Yeah, he was like, you know, he called me his angel of the Chilkoot. And it's like, no, just doing my job.
Yeah, but he must have felt like he was really in trouble.
He was really in trouble, yeah. He would have died up there, I think.
Well, it's nice that people appreciate that you helped them.
Oh, yeah, it was fun. And I was just thinking of one of the guys I worked with, Ron Tate. He was one of our bilingual guys, and he was a real athlete. You know, people used to always think of him as this Greek Adonis, you know, because he liked to run around without his shirt on a sunny day. It's like, Ron, you have to wear a shirt. But one time we had these two plant biologists out there, and they were, you know, methodically going along the trail recording all the different plant species, the alpine plant species. And one time they did not show up at Lindemann. And so we were radioed, you know, it was Ron and I were up at the summit. And we get this call probably from Christine, and she's like, oh, these two guys haven't showed up down here. We don't know where they are. And they said they were going to go around the other side of Crater Lake. And it was once again pouring rain. So Ron said, well, I'll go out, you stay here in case they show up here. And so Ron heads out in this horrible weather. And he said, I'm going to go around the other side of Crater Lake. So if I don't show up, you know where I am. So he goes and he comes back. And these two guys in the meantime had showed up in Lindemann. But Ron shows up back at Stone Crib with a package of bacon. And I said, where did you find the bacon? And he said, I found it on the trail. Let's have some. So we're sitting up there late at night cooking up this bacon.
Well, at least his search was fruitful.
Oh, it was funny. It was really funny.
Were there any times where, you know, hikers would go off the trail and get lost or to be found?
Well, nobody got lost, but people certainly, you know, especially in a whiteout, you know, you could, you know, we tried to mark it super well, but people did wander off. But the way the trail is, you know, it's a pretty narrow valley. You know, you could wander off for a bit, but you would eventually figure out you're going in one direction. But you could wander around for a bit.
But you never had to go out and find somebody other than these plant guys?
Not that I can recall, no. People would sometimes cut across from the highway. It's called Paddy's Pass. You can drop down into Stone Crib. So Debbie got lost up in there one time. No, not lost, but she went up there with one of the bilingual guys, Paul. And there was a lot of snow and they got kind of stuck.
So that was a way to take a shortcut?
It was like sort of a shortcut, but not really.
Yeah, if you know the way.
If you know the way, and there's no trail, so it's just cross country.
Yeah.
So,
well, and so besides the archaeological surveys and there's a plant work going on, was there other research that went on based from the trail?
There are park planners. There were park planners that came through, that was probably mid-80s too, out of Winnipeg. And there was a group of about four of them. And they were looking at long-term planning for the park, you know, how will it be developed? And, you know, I don't think very much was ever put in place, obviously, But there were all, you know, they were, I think they had public meetings, and so they hiked the trail, and then they had public meetings in Whitehorse and Carcross and probably Skagway, and tried to get public input and all that.
When you mentioned that year when there were so many people, that there was a trail survey crew, so what were they doing?
Well, they were just surveying the trail. So I don't know what surveyors do, but they were just...
like mapping the trail?
Mapping the trail.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I keep saying, okay, we're done, and then we think of something else to talk about.
I know.
So that's why I don't want to turn it off, because we're going to even think of another good story.
Yeah. Well, lots of romances came out of the trail.
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah.
There you go. Good subject.
Well, the year I started, actually, Chaz Dentz on the American side and Christy Heron got together. They're still married, as far as I know, so that's 35 years mm-hmm. or something, yeah. So, and then I met, like I said, my first husband, and then I met Frank, so that's another one. Debbie, who's now Debbie Verhall, didn't meet her husband in Whitehorse, but they met in Riding Mountain and ended up coming back to Whitehorse when she went down there for that warden training.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. But, you know, it kind of makes sense because people are at that age, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, there perhaps were also some summer romances.
Oh, I'm sure there were lots.
Amongst the crews.
Yeah.
That may or may not last.
Yeah, mostly not, I think.
Yeah. But it makes for good stories.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Okay. Oh, and the stuff at Bennett now, there's sort of interpretive material and there's some old buildings still standing at Bennett.
Well, there's the old train building that they called it the Eating House. And I think Parks Canada has some kind of interpretive thing set up down there.
Yeah.
But I don't know because it wasn't there when I was there.
Yeah.
And I really don't know what's happening with the Eating House. You know, last time I saw it, it was kind of slowly being, you know, just falling apart because nobody was doing anything with it.
And was it the old train depot at Bennett? What was it?
Well, it wasn't a depot, really. I mean, I guess... a depot, but it was basically where the trains would come from Whitehorse and from Skagway, meet there, and people would get off the train, go and eat their moose stew, which came from a can, biscuits and pie, and then they'd pile back on to either the same or a different train, depending on which way they were going to go. And so, yeah.
So this was a part of the tourist experience?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, they did that every day at noon or whatever time they would show up in Bennett.
But by after 1983, they didn't do that.
They didn't do that anymore.
But again, they started in 88, so you were still on the trail. Didn't they start again in 88, something like that?
I don't think they were running by the time I left. I'm trying to think. Maybe they were. Because I seem to recall there were trains and they had cars just for hikers. So maybe the last couple of years.
Yeah. We need Frank here to tell us the date.
Yeah, because
I didn't carry his whole admin history book with me on this trip. But I kind of have the date 88 in my head.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
We used to, because, you know, when we were going on days off, they would, Parks Canada would pay for us to ride the Casey car in and out if we happened to catch it, you know, which was just the little work car. It looked like a little orange car with a few seats inside and they could move it up and down the tracks to do trail work.
How was it moved? You didn't use a hand crank thing.
No, it wasn't a hand crank. I think it must have been a little gas operated thing. So, you know.
Was it covered or was it open?
Yeah, it was covered.
Okay.
And then it had a little wagon they could haul it, the tools and stuff in the back so we could throw our packs in there. So that was nice if we could ever hitch a ride with them so we didn't have to walk those 7 miles.
And as we said, there was that cutoff.
right.
to the tracks that then you'd walk down to the highway that they don't want people using anymore.
They didn't want people using it then, but because they weren't running trains most of the time, they didn't care. But now, you know, I understand why. Because they don't want people to get run over by the train.
Right.
Especially now people like to walk with headphones all the time, so.
Yeah. Well, and it does provide that much more income for the White Pass if you have hikers who need a ride.
Mm-hmm. To take the train.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were a lot of people that came and went all the years I worked there, and yeah.
And besides Christine, you worked very closely with any others who were particularly influential for you?
Well, my friend Debbie Tozak, she and I are still friends, you know, we're lifelong friends. And she worked there 1 year before I got there, and then she and I worked together for several years, and then she went off and did her warden training, and then she came back, and I actually ended up supervising her one season, and then the next year she supervised me, because she wasn't finished her warden training. When she came back, she was a warden, so she was my boss. And then Danny Cresswell, he and I were real close. He was one of the First Nations guys. He was a fun guy to work with.
Anybody you could think of as a mentor? I mean, because you went out there pretty young and inexperienced.
You know, I think Christine was a mentor when I worked there, initially at least.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a lot from her. She's, you know, she's a walking encyclopedia. If you want to know anything about the Chilkoot, I mean anything, she's your woman. She just, you know, she's got an institutional memory. She's been there forever.
She's like Carl Gerke.
Yeah.
Equivalent, sounds like.
Just, you know, and I think she probably, I mean, I don't know, but she used to just instant recall, you know, she knew all the stuff.
Yeah.
She met her husband there too. They're not together anymore, but they did meet out there. So.
Good stories, good times.
Yeah, really was. I was glad to have all those years out there, that's for sure. It's not, you know, I can remember hikers, you know, they'd talk to me and like, oh, well, how'd you get this job? It's like, well, I applied for the job, I got the job. Oh, you must know people. It's like, no, I just got the job.
Well,
lucky.
Probably after the first year or two, it was easier to get rehired.
Oh, yeah. There wasn't, you know, I didn't have to be interviewed or anything like that, so.
But you did have to reapply every year?
I don't think it was a real formal process, you know, I think I had to signal my interest and they had to put the paperwork through, but I didn't have to submit anything particularly that I recall, so.
So what, was it a particularly competitive, position that it was coveted and it was competitive to work on the Chilkoot?
I really don't know. The way I found out about it was I was going to school in Vancouver and my friend, one of my oldest and dearest friends, was living in Whitehorse at the time, and she knew a guy who had worked on the trail the year before, and he wasn't going to go back. And he told her, oh, yeah, I worked out there, but I didn't like it. I'm not going to go back. So she immediately got in touch with me and said, he's not going back. Apply for this job. So, you know, I don't know how many people applied, but they must have seen that I was young and enthusiastic.
So when you became the supervisor, were you responsible for hiring the crew for that season?
I don't think I hired anybody. I think everybody was returning, so it was just the same people.
Did you get to fire anybody?
No, but I got to caution a few people about their work.
And then they did not return?
One of them was just a young guy who was, he was actually the First Nations guy that year. He wasn't highly motivated and he, you know, I don't think he really enjoyed being out there, so he didn't come back. So. It's not everybody's cup of tea.
No.
To be out in the bush, nobody around, nobody to party with, no video games, no nothing.
Yeah, and for months on at end.
Yeah.
In bad weather.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't miss the mosquitoes.
There you go.
Yeah, they were bad. I remember really? That. Not always. You know, Lindemann's often a very windy spot, so that's the savior. But there were times bad.
Did you have a favorite spot on the trail?
Oh, I think I just really liked being up at... when we had Stone Crib, I liked being up there. Especially if I was up there by myself. And, you know, the people would all have gone through and then it would get dark and maybe the northern lights would come out and stars would come out if you're lucky. And, during the day, it was beautiful. Just the lake was a turquoise blue and mountains all around, snow covered. It's beautiful.
Sounds beautiful. Okay.
Well.
Anything else? And here you thought you didn't have anything to say about it.
Yeah. Well, I thought. Well, I don't know. I don't know any of the insider trading that went on. You know, as far as getting things established, as far as the international park or any of the hiring, firing, or you know, any of that stuff.
It was nice to hear sort of the representation of what it was like, you know, living out on the trail for a summer.
Yeah.
Not everybody gets that experience.
No. It was a very cool experience.
So any regrets?
I regret maybe that I didn't get to go into the warden service a little bit. Just a little bit. You know, I would have enjoyed that life. I know I would have.
Mm-hmm. Anything about what you did on the trail that you wished, is there something you wish you could have had an opportunity to do that you never did?
No, I don't think so.
Like there wasn't some project you wish had been done that wasn't done?
Oh, there were things that never got finished, but not from us. Like I know that the archaeologists, you know, they were there at least two different seasons, and they were there for months on end. And while they were nice guys, they never turned in a report.
Oh.
So, you know, and I heard that from my boss, the warden at the time. I don't know if they eventually managed to come around, but he said the little thing that I did, you know, my little photograph with the compass bearings and everything was the most complete collection of all the artifacts that they had, which is sad.
Yeah, and what year would that have been?
Oh, around 88.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, that took me a season to go to walk to all the spots, photograph them all.
And that was before GPS.
Yeah, it was before a GPS, so... but you know, they were supposed to be doing whatever they do, but they didn't do it. So,
do you think there's any memory of you that people think, oh yeah, she worked on the trail. We remember her.
Oh yeah. Well, Debbie and I, when we worked together, I think we had quite a reputation for being pretty tough. Oh. I know it sort of got back to us when the archaeologists were out there. They said, oh yeah, Debbie and Candy, you gotta watch out for them. I think just because, you know, we didn't take any crap from anybody, you know. It's like, but I think we were a lot of fun. I think people would think of me as somebody that liked to have a lot of fun. But that, you know, I worked hard. I was a really hard worker.
Yeah. Well, were you and Debbie tough because it was in a man's world and you had to be, or that was just your personalities?
I think partly that. Definitely, you know, that you were expected to work as hard as a man. There wasn't any, you know, concession. Well, you're a woman, you don't have to carry the big pack. You're the woman, here's the big pack. I have to tell you one story. So we did have a little bit of interaction with the Kluani guys. We did some training, like, I think first aid stuff and shotgun training and things like that. And so we got to know them a little bit. And then when I left, when I said I wasn't going to come back, one of them, or actually a couple of them, came out to Lindemann because they were kind of looking at the terrain as far as rough terrain stuff. and we played this game called Spoons. Have you ever played Spoons?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Spoons can be a very docile game, or it can be a really rough game. So you, basically, if there's four people playing, you deal out four cards to each person. And you pass cards until you get four of a kind. And in the middle, there's a spoon. And so you take the spoon, and then everybody else tries to take the spoon from you. Mm-hmm. So we were playing at Lindemann, and the game was, it was a rough game. And we had this big, like this, the table was here, and then we had this big wood stove that was
behind
here.
Behind you guys. Yeah.
Yeah. So this park warden and I were fighting over this spoon, right? And he didn't know that stove was off, but I knew it was off. So I was pushing him toward the stove. He thought I was going to incinerate him just to get the spoon. But, you know, I was strong enough to pin him down, so...
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
So what are the... Yeah, entertainment. You said, you know, playing the card games or the... dressing those guys up. What else did you guys do? Did you play a lot of cards or cribbage or read
books?
We
played cribbage. Well, read books. I don't know. We did all kinds of crazy things. I remember there was a guy, Bill Overend. He was the athletic guy. And, you know, when we came out in the summer, we could make, buy certain foods that we liked, and you could share or not share. But, you know, mostly it was all communal food. But I really liked chocolate pudding. So I remember I actually had a garbage can full of chocolate pudding for the summer. And Bill decided he liked my chocolate pudding. So I noticed my chocolate pudding was disappearing. So anyhow, we ended up having a big chocolate pudding fight one night. So I have pictures of us covered in chocolate pudding.
Oh, it was literally a chocolate pudding fight.
Oh, yeah. A food fight. And then Debbie and I, when we worked together, we had this boss, Tom Elliott. And Tom was smaller than both of us. Like, he's not a very tall guy. And we picked on that poor man mercilessly. We were so mean to him. But he had a good sense of humor. He took it all in stride. Every time he would come out to the trail, which was several times in the summer, there was always going to be a time when he was going to get a meringue pie in the face. Always.
Did you know when he was coming?
Oh, yeah. We always had a pie.
Well, and I wondered, you mentioned, you know, the supervisors and the people in Whitehorse, and I wondered how often they came out.
He came out, you know, several times in the summer, but sometimes, you know, we'd see the superintendents once or twice.
I wouldn't expect the superintendents, but some of the other... people.
Yeah, the park wardens, when they started working, they'd come out some, but like Jim McIntyre, he might have come out once. He just wasn't a backcountry kind of guy, but Tom Elliott was more, so he would come out more.
I was thinking about the male-female differential and made me think about salaries and how much you were paid for this work.
It was all the same. I think we got paid about $16 an hour, which was pretty good money for that time.
Really?
We were like rich compared to the poor American Rangers. I remember they got paid a pittance.
Really?
It was bad. Like, I think they got half of what we got. Plus, we got a food allowance. So they would buy our food and we got our wages. And so basically, you know, came out ahead at the end of the summer.
And if you were not in Whitehorse and you had to get there to start the job for the season, you had to pay your own way?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So,
I was wondering, it made me think about, was it a decently paid job? You could make a living on it?
Well, you know, seasonal living, yeah. But yeah, I mean, I would come out with, you know, a little nest egg for the winter.
So you didn't necessarily have to work in the winter?
I didn't always work in the winter, no. Often I didn't work, actually.
Well, I guess, $16 an hour doesn't sound like a lot by today's standards, but again, you didn't have any expenses, and you were out on the trail.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, you know, when we came off, I was staying with friends, so it was just whatever you spent on food or entertainment when you were off the trail.
Or maybe you lost a few bucks gambling and spoons.
Right. No, I won at spoons. Yeah.
Cool. Okay?
Yeah, I guess so.
I'm open to hearing more.
No, I mean, you know, I could go on for hours and hours, I'm sure. But, no, it was fun. It was always fun.
Well, it sounds like it. Mm-hmm. I can't believe that it was always all fun, but...
No, it wasn't always all fun, but, you know, my overriding feeling for it 40 years, 30 years later is... That was a lot of fun.
Would you do it again?
Oh, in a heartbeat. Absolutely. Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Thank you very much.